This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to LGBTQ News and Culture. Featuring articles from leading LGBTQ publications, this program offers you a comprehensive look at the issues facing the LGBTQ community and its allies. Available only on the audio reading service, it's LGBTQ News and Culture, coming up next.
Welcome. This is LGBTQ News and Culture, and I'm your reader Jason with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading from the September-October issue of Out Magazine, copyright 2025 Equal Pride, starting with Operation Broadway. Fresh from a Tony win, Jack Malone and his Operation Mincemeat co-star David Cumming talk bringing their gender-bending historical musical to life, by Moises Mendez II. It's a mystery what happens in an actor's dressing room right before they take the stage. Every performer has a different ritual, especially when it comes to playing an emotionally taxing role, or in the case of Operation Mincemeat, roles, plural. The Olivier Award-winning musical comedy about the covert British military operation to divert Nazi troops from Sicily, where the Allies were planning to invade during World War II, requires boundless energy and nuance for the five actors who play over 80 characters in the production. Role changes are communicated to the audience through minor adjustments to costumes and posture. So how does one prepare to take on multiple personalities in this dizzyingly funny production at Broadway's John Golden Theater? The back of the house at a theater may look familiar to those who live in a pre-war building in New York City. Carpeted stairs, a rickety handrail plastered in layers of paint, and most dreadful of all, a steep climb up multiple flights of stairs. David Cumming and Jack Malone, two of the show's stars, share a dressing room on the top floor. It's a feat that they do the trek so often. The two are having a conversation as this winded writer greets them both. "Take your time, catch your breath," Malone says with a hug. Cumming stands from his chair in the middle of powdering his face to usher me into their dressing room. They are half ready. Malone is in the middle of eating on his side of the room, hair and makeup secured in place, as Cumming carefully applies eyeliner. The show was written by Natasha Hodgson, who plays Ewan Montague and others, Zoe Roberts, Johnny Bevan and others, Felix Hagen, he doesn't appear in the play, and Cumming, who identifies as queer, and they make up the comedy collective Spit Lip. We get together to try our hand, for the first time in our lives, to try and write a commercial piece of theater, Cumming explains. The idea was we'd write something good enough that a producer who had a show that they wanted made would then pay us money to make that show. It was Hodgson who introduced the group to an episode from the Stuff You Should Know podcast about a British military operation during World War II called Operation Mincemeat. The group dove into research, dividing the work among themselves, and then they'd meet again to pass it to the left so that everyone's work would get torn apart, Cumming says. This is the sixth iteration of the show, so it's taken six times to get it almost right. That work paid off. After winning two Olivier Awards, Britain's highest award in theater, for Best New Musical and for Malone as Best Actor in a Supporting Role in a Musical, in addition to a Tony Award, along with multiple nominations, the show is undoubtedly a success. Malone and Claire Marie Hall, who plays Jean Leslie and others, joined the production later. The former managed to catch the group's attention by creating some fan art of the members after seeing a Spit Lip show at the Edinburgh Festival Fringe when he was a drama student. There was an open audition for Operation Mincemeat. He won the cast over and became a part of this ragtag group of comics. Operation Mincemeat made its world premiere in 2019 at the new Diorama Theater and moved to various venues in London before landing in the West End, where it received critical praise, 74 five-star reviews, and an eventual transfer to Broadway. Since its nascent days, the musical amassed a rabid online following of fans who call themselves Mincefluencers. The show's main conceit is that the audience is watching a musical comedy about a somewhat weighty topic with gender-swapped performances. We were worried because, since we live in a patriarchal, misogynistic society, if you put a man dressed as a woman on stage, it's automatically seen as a comic role, Cummings says. The members were concerned that having a man in feminine clothing would only provoke laughs, even in more serious moments. But once they saw Malone do the production's showstopper, Dear Bill, they knew they had made the right decision. The show has changed Malone's life in more ways than one. Since performing in Operation Mincemeat, he's become even more interested in the idea of bending gender binaries, he says. I've always been fascinated by the gender of it all, by my own gender, and how some fabrics make me feel more feminine, and what shapes make me feel more masculine, he says. I'm the most comfortable in my skin I've ever been. I feel like my most wonderful, blurry, gendered self, and I'm really enjoying it. And I owe Hester a lot for opening that side of me. His red carpet looks for press events leading up to and at the Tony nominations saw him outfitted in more feminine clothing alongside his longtime partner, Jasmine. Malone shares that his identity has always been a topic of conversation, as society likes to keep people in boxes. His sexuality is never something he wanted to make a judgment call on, he says, but queer is the only label I feel comfortable giving myself. Malone and, it seems, the rest of the cast are still swapping their heads around just how massive the musical has become, especially after Malone's Tony win. But it continues to steal hearts and grow its fan base night after night. Cummings sees why the show has done so well. One of the strongest bits about the show is that it's a story about five people convincing 100,000 German troops of something that isn't real, Cummings says. We play the same game as five actors on stage, tricking 800 people a night into believing something enough that isn't real, but it moves them in a certain way. It's only work. Some professionals have turned to creating adult content as a side hustle, or even full-time work. Is it worth it? By Nick Wolny. I scroll my social feeds on a lazy Saturday afternoon and stumble across a video of a Chicano mailman, his words, not mine, walking through a neighborhood in the scorching summer sun. His decollage framed by the baby blue USPS button-up listens with sweat. It's hot, so I tap on his profile, which leads me to a link in bio, which leads me to, well, you know. In less than a minute, I've leapt from the innocence of blue-collar TikTok to the OnlyFans home page of an honest mailman trying to support his wife and two kids, where he'll show me the package I've really been waiting for if I cough up $14 and subscribe. Between 25% and 40% of Americans, and over half of millennials and Gen Z, have a side hustle, depending on which surveys you reference. And for some, that extra income comes from turning a camera on and taking clothes off. Adult creatorship is certainly one of the riskier side hustle options. Diamonds are forever, and so is the internet. So the decision to dip into adult content creation feels like a point of no return, with very real professional implications. There's also that part where, in an effort to monetize our interests, we sometimes end up ruining them instead. With so much of gay digital culture adjacent to sex, it's hard to navigate queer life without encountering references to platforms like JustForFans, OnlyFans, and cam sites. One can't help but wonder, what's it like for people who do this? Did the wave already crest during pandemic-era quarantines, Or can some start today and still make a viable income? And should they? Curious, I asked several current and past adult content creators what it's like. From physician in training to porn star. In 2020, Thomas Long, a stage name, was finishing up medical school. But doing clinicals in 2020 understandably sucked, Long says. No one in hospitals wanted to work with students at the time. And the arrival of COVID-19 opened his eyes to how his chosen career path could lead to a life of long hours and internal bureaucracy. I made the decision when I finished school that I wasn't going to practice medicine, he says. When a friend suggested he look into OnlyFans, Long notes that the financial timing was a big factor. Payments on his student loan debt were paused, a suspension that lasted nearly 3.5 years, and he had savings from previous work, so he didn't have to make a full-time income right away. He says he had enough runway to give it a try. It was difficult. I didn't really know what I was doing, says Long. The inexperience didn't matter because quarantines limited our in-person activities, which led many of us to be chronically online. The perfect petri dish for rapid online audience growth. Long says he only made a couple hundred of dollars in his first few months, but his subscriptions steadily grew, and eventually he saw potential to go full-time. Collabs helped. One video he did with a top studio creator led to 900 new subscriptions, the equivalent of several thousand dollars a month in additional income. However, he says online fame can take an emotional toll. Being so vulnerable and open on the internet, I 100% feel like some of my life isn't my life anymore, he told me. OnlyFans has definitely given me more confidence in some aspects, but it's also changed my internal dialogue. I grew up in the humble Midwest. I'm trying to guard myself and prevent any of this from changing who I am at the core. Long says he'll milk his platforms and content for as long as he can, but subscriptions aren't what they used to be since the November election, and he's planning his soft exit. He also says the online landscape is much tougher now. The Twitter takeover and changing of the algorithm messed things up, he says. A friend of mine in real estate asked me about OnlyFans the other day. He said he wanted to start one, and I thought to myself, you shouldn't. Man in finance with a side of foot fetish. For DJ Guy Rubin, OnlyFans is squarely a secondary source of income. He's been making foot fetish videos with hookups for his private enjoyment for years, but never shared anything publicly, instead using his social media handles to promote DJ gigs. Then COVID-19 rolled in. When the pandemic happened, I was like, well, the world's going to end. Why not just put my videos on OnlyFans and see if anybody is interested, he says. As he posted sneak peeks of his content on Twitter, his following picked up rapidly. He says he had about 2,000 followers at the time, compared to just over 54,000 followers today, but agreed it's harder now to get preview posts seen. Rather than lead with subscriptions, he keeps his account free, then sells individual videos in a pay-per-video format. He notes that he's had a full-time corporate job in finance this whole time, and that although some months have been good, he's never made more money in a month doing OnlyFans than he has at his day job. He also monitors his online presence regularly. If you Google my real name, none of this comes up, he says. I check it all of the time. I even checked it the other day. I thought about the fear of being discovered, how it lingers in the background, and how that feeling might be anxious in some moments and thrilling in others. If it were ever to come up at work, I don't know how I would navigate it, he says. I guess they'd just fire me, or I'd have to figure it out. Overall, though, his experience seemed positive. I genuinely love it, he says. An online vanishing act. Dylan Cotter says the way he arrived in the adult business directly reflects his lived experience as a gay trans man. After transitioning in 2016, He says his network changed dramatically, and it became harder to find work as a marketing consultant, a challenge that compounded during the pandemic. I lost a lot of people in my life. It was very disappointing, he says. When the pandemic hit, I thought to myself, wow, how am I ever going to survive this? Cotter says he signed up for OnlyFans, Just for Fans, and others to do solo content creator work. He declined to share numbers, but says what he was making on platforms was enough to cover his living expenses, and he could do so without having scene partners. Femme performers gave me a lot of great advice about boundaries and just standing firm on what you believe and to not feel bad about them, he says. A lot of the time, people just think of you as a sex object that exists on their phone. After a few years, he exited the industry and used his reputation management skills to remove videos and cover his digital tracks. He now focuses his energy on non-adult work and trans activism, including writing a memoir that came out this year. Something I'm not ready for. Others who like to show off their sexiness on platforms like Instagram and X have no interest in taking the adult content monetization route. Hornhulk, a Seattle-based art professional and adjunct professor, explains that part of his job involves mentoring young adults, and that even if he were to create something paywalled that wasn't overtly sexual, the stigma of having an account on an adult platform would do more harm than good. I don't want that to be findable to my students, he says. Doing full-on porn for other people to watch is something I'm not ready for yet, and maybe won't ever be. At the time of this writing, OnlyFans is up for sale, with a price tag of up to $8 billion. And while technocracy is a mood right now, one could argue adult creator platforms have enabled a higher degree of safety and control for those who choose to pursue this line of work. The nuance comes in the creator's motivation. Some arrive through curiosity, whereas for others it can feel like an act of survival. That's the kind of vibe our entire economy is giving these days. Wealth gaps are widening, billionaires are vacuuming up all the profits, and it sometimes feels like our bodies and minds are the only assets we get to own anymore, although the right to bodily autonomy is being questioned now too. I'll never knock someone down for hustling up a few bucks, as long as they're not causing harm to others. And we should continue to be critical and educate ourselves on how capitalism has led us to this landscape. In the meantime, if someone wants to monetize their body or mind to improve their financial situation, who are we to judge? The making of Mackie. As the subject of a new documentary film, designer Bob Mackie reflects on his iconic collaborations and legacy by Bernardo Sim. Bob Mackie's imaginative designs have been worn by Hollywood's most glamorous and powerful people for over six decades. A new documentary, Bob Mackie, Naked Illusion, details the extraordinary life and career of a creative genius who's become the gold standard for iridescent, daring, and show-stopping costumes. Mackie's work evokes past eras, defies present-day taboos, and inspires future generations to razzle and dazzle as fiercely as possible. Born Robert Gordon Mackie on March 24, 1939, in Montgomery Park, California, Mackie recalls how his love of movies inspired his career. I'd see an actor and say, that doesn't look great on them. They're not giving them no favors, Mackie says. You have to really be careful what you put people in. You can't make them feel intimidated or uncomfortable as a performer. Mackie dropped out of college at 22 and started working for Hollywood creatives like Frank Thompson and designers like Jean-Louis. A year into his career, Mackie drew the original sketch for the dress Marilyn Monroe wore at President John F. Kennedy's 1962 birthday bash. He also worked as an assistant at Paramount Studios to designer Ray Agayan, who later became his long-term partner. I never think of myself as being in fashion. I'm a costume designer in show business, which isn't the same. A costume designer really contributes to the storytelling of a production, Mackie says, which is evidenced through his work. Carol Burnett says in the documentary that Mackie made an estimated 17,000 outfits as the sole costume designer of The Carol Burnett Show for 11 years. The world has reconsidered its relationship with Barbie dolls after Greta Gerwig's 2023 film, but Mackie has been expanding the doll's horizons since the 1980s. "I'm still grinding out a Barbie doll every now and then. She's one of the biggest stars in our country right now, and has been for many years," he says. "I've done over 60 Barbie dolls in my career as a doll designer." Mackie pushed Mattel over the years for changes to Barbie's outfits and in the doll's face and hair, which led to the famous Mackie face sculpt in 1992. "Why is an old man like me interested in doing Barbie?" he teases. "I just thought she didn't have to be a secretary, waitress, or housewife. If she could be anything, she could be the most amazing creature." While the designer is often praised for his life's work and long-lasting collaborations with Cher, Burnett, and even Elton John, his creations are still firmly in the zeitgeist. Miley Cyrus won her first Grammy Award in 2024 and delivered an exhilarating performance of Flowers during the ceremony, all in full Bob Mackie fantasy. "How about that?" Mackie says. "I knew her as a young little girl, a disco kid, and I thought, well, she's cute and she's got some kind of a big old voice, which was interesting. And then I got to meet her as an adult and I thought, wow, they do grow up." Zendaya is another young star who's made headlines for wearing a Mackie original. Her stylist, Law Roach, appears in the Naked Illusion documentary and praises the designer's legacy. "Isn't he a number?" Mackie says about Roach, adding that Zendaya is gorgeous, like a baby Cher, kind of. She's also someone who could do it all. A regular reference point on RuPaul's Drag Race, RuPaul once said, "We're all born naked, and the rest is Bob Mackie." In season 13 of the drag reality competition, contestant Kimora Hall branded herself as Chicago's Mackie doll and discussed how his work inspired her artistry. "I tell Mackie that I asked Hall to send me a question to ask him on her behalf." "Oh, I know Kimora Hall. I met her," Mackie says before I get to the question. "We met at the Cher show in Chicago. She was there in evening clothes, hair done and everything. She was fantastic. We used to always see if there was anything for sale for my first client ever, Mitzi Gaynor. She could wear Mitzi's old dresses, and they'd fit her perfectly." He adds, "Every now and then I'll see a big billboard on the street, and there's Kimora Hall on it, advertising God knows what. I don't know," laughing. "But she's always looking good." Then we get to Hall's question. "Was there ever a moment when you ran out of material, fabric, and or feathers for a specific look, and you were forced to think of a plan B at the last minute?" Mackie replies, "Sometimes yes, especially when I did so much TV and everything had to be done in a day or two. It was crazy. We'd start on Monday and shoot the whole show on Friday afternoon. You always had to think about what you could do instead of if you couldn't do the original." How does it feel for Mackie to still be a source of inspiration for global pop stars like Cyrus, movie stars like Zendaya, and Drag Race queens like Hall? "Well, it's not for everybody," he responds. "But those girls, they really get it." Looking ahead, Mackie explains that he's working on a possible big Vegas show based on his career. "That would be fun to do. I've done a lot of huge Vegas shows in the past, but I haven't done one lately," Mackie says. "It's always really fun to get an audience reaction to things that I just do naturally." Mackie also shares a message with LGBTQ+ people who are navigating these turbulent times. "Just be honest with yourself," he says. "Do what you do best. Try to work your life so that it works for you in the best possible way. Sometimes there are ways that just aren't the best. Try to think about that, too." Bob Mackie Naked Illusions is streaming on Amazon Prime, Google Play, and Apple TV Plus. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Jason with LGBTQ News and Culture. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.